It's our second talk this afternoon, and it'll follow the format of the first. Some remarks and then some time for some questions and answers. It's my pleasure to introduce Nicole Guidotti Hernandez, who is Associate Professor of Gender and Women's Studies at the University of Arizona and the current Senior Postdoctoral Fellow in the Center for Mexican American Studies at the University of Texas, Austin. Professor Guidotti Hernandez received her doctorate degree from Cornell University in 2004, and her book, Unspeakable Violence, Remapping U.S. and Mexican National Imaginaries, is forthcoming with Duke University Press sometime this fall. She's a former postdoctoral fellow at the Center for Race, Politics, and Culture at the University of Chicago, and William J. Fulbright Postdoctoral Fellow at the UNAM in Mexico City. And she is at work on two new books, Santa Lucia, Contemporary Chicana and Latina Cultural Reinterpretations of Saint Iconographies, and Red Devils and Railroads, Race, Gender, and Capitalism in the Transnational 19th Century Mexico Borderlands. Both of which sound excellent, if I do say so myself, as somebody who has some pretty similar interests. Her talk today is Arizona, a Problematic Roadmap for Nebraska and Other States. So please join me in welcoming Professor Nicole Guidotti Hernandez.
Good afternoon. I just want to thank the tremendous welcome that I've, the individuals that have given me a tremendous welcome here at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. The last time I was in Nebraska, I was driving across Nebraska to go to graduate school many, many years ago. So this is nice to actually see things and talk to people and meet with folks at such a pressing political time in the history of the state. I'd also like to thank Amelia and the organizing crew from the Center for Great Plains Studies, because this is a tremendous symposium. It couldn't be more salient time-wise. I sadly have to announce that my talk is going to be Debbie Downer compared to Sergio's. So bear with me. But then again, my book is about a series of lynchings and Indian massacres along the U.S.-Mexico border, so it's also very consistent with the kind of scholarship that I'm committed to in the name of social and political justice. So I just want to point out that a lot of these photos were actually taken by myself. I took this at one of the first protests in Tucson against SB 1070, and what I really love about the way that this social movement is taking shape is that people and their children are coming, and you know, this little girl has a sign on her stroller that says she can't deport us all, referring to Arizona's governor, Jan Brewer. So with that, I'm going to sort of start with Arizona and then kind of work my way outward to other places and end in Nebraska. I'm hoping that this talk will generate a conversation. I think that's what we're severely lacking. Instead of people yelling at each other on TV, talk shows, all of those venues, I'm really hoping, and I think that what we need is a sustained, thoughtful conversation. So I'm going to present a lot of facts, and I'm hoping that that can, if not generate a conversation in this room, generate a conversation in your classrooms, with your family, with your grandparents, with your pen pals, whoever it may be. I just think this is a tremendous opportunity for us to talk. So because I do historical work, I'm going to start with a series of historical claims. Arizona has a sordid past filled with incidents of racialized forms of state violence. For example, during the 1870s, then-Governor Anson Safford claimed that indigenous groups such as the Apaches were an impediment to capitalist growth, dedicating state resources to force Apache communities onto reservations, which culminated in such brutality as the notorious 1871 Camp Grant Indian Massacre. And I have a chapter about that in my book, but it's not ready yet, so look for it. We could also talk about the Great Arizona Orphan Abduction that Linda Golden tells us of, an incident in 1904 when a group of New York Irish orphans were sent to live with Catholic Mexican families in Morenci in Arizona, which caused the outrage of local Anglos who then rescued the children at gunpoint. Then there's the Cold War McCarran-Walter Act and Operation Wetback of 1954 that my colleague and good friend historian Geraldo Cadava has written of, where both policies justify the deportation of suspected subversives, creating another pretext for discrimination in the name of Cold War necessity, which led to 50,000 Mexican deportations that same year. The contemporary moment is no different. The peak of the current political crisis began when then Arizona Governor Janet Napolitano became the first woman appointed as the Director of Homeland Security in January of 2009. You would think that this would have been a victory for women's equity, but that was not the case when she left office. Known as a champion of women's rights and for vetoing ill-advised attempts to regulate ethnic studies programs in Arizona high schools and bills that proposed immigration crackdown, Napolitano felt that immigration was a federal issue that local law enforcement had no business in enforcing. In fact, she left office with the record for the most vetoes issued by a governor in the state of Arizona history with 180, which is 67 more vetoes than Governor Goldwater. Her departure from office unleashed a series of chain reaction legislative bombs that have reverberated throughout the nation, with one of the biggest political storms of the 21st century settled on the Arizona-Mexico border. Enter Governor Jan Brewer. In only 1 year and a few months, she has managed to clear the way for a climate of fear in the state. Her greatest accomplishment, according to those who support inhumane border control policy, are SB 1070 and HB 2281. Passed on April 24th of 2010, SB 1070, quote, requires officials and agencies to reasonably attempt to determine the immigration status of a person involved in a lawful contact where reasonable suspicion exists regarding the immigration status of a person, end quote. And as you can see on this slide, here are a few highlights of the bill. I'm not going to read through it because it's a lot and I have tons of material. The other piece of legislation that has received tremendous national attention is HB 2281 that was, according to then Arizona State Superintendent Tom Horn, designated to curtail how the Tucson Unified School District's Mexican American Studies program teaches Latino students that they are oppressed by white people. The law ignores multi-ethnic immigrant histories, preferring to single out one ethnic group, Mexican Americans, and the area of study attached to their history in the Tucson Unified School District. Ethnic studies fields, be they American Indian studies, Asian American studies, Chicano Latino studies, African American studies, and gender women's studies, were formed out of the civil rights movement, seeking to redress the exclusion of women and minorities from traditional fields of study. In these fields, students are taught to analyze structures of inequality along the lines of race, class, gender, and sexuality in the name of bettering society for all, a society that is tolerant, mindful of history, and socially respectable. As a professor of ethnic and gender studies in Arizona, I am very disturbed that people do not know the difference between a field of actual intellectual inquiry and racial separatism. In these academic fields, to paraphrase my colleague and chair of the Ethnic Studies Department at UC Riverside, Dylan Rodriguez, we teach practical and theoretical texts addressing questions of power, social movements, freedom, liberation, community, culture, inequality, and history. Our scholarly commitment is reflected in what we teach, what we write, and how we empower students to imagine a world that is better for us all. So my own department at the University of Arizona, Gender and Women's Studies, challenged President Robert Shelton to denounce SB 1070 and HB 2281 because they restrict academic freedom and access to the university. And here are a few excerpts of our letter that we wrote. And rather than read through it, I just want to point out that our president, Robert Shelton, later called the law flawed, but did not denounce it or refuse enforcement. And one of the things that I was really pleased to see today was that the chancellor was here this morning, and he's very much a supporter of equal access to educational institutions, something that I wish the president of my institution could take a cue from. So myself, among others, obviously have a problem with this because it does not protect students or faculty and staff performing their jobs, and it really kind of reinforces this climate of fear. I don't know if you've heard about the recent legislation talk in both Texas and Arizona talking about college and high school students being able to carry guns on campus. So this is part of a larger climate that I would argue is prevailing the state and kind of bleeding out into other places. But in light of this climate of fear, for the 100,000 people who marched six miles in the searing 100-degree heat on the morning of May 29th, 2010, exercising the right to free public assembly, this was a paramount part of imagining a more inclusive Arizona, one that peacefully and nonviolently critiques both the human rights crisis on the U.S.-Mexico border and the Obama administration's delayed response to the legislation that targets Latinos and other brown-skinned peoples in the state. And we can also talk about how this is linked to the discourse of terrorism, because I think they're very, very connected. What's important about this march that happened in Phoenix is that people came from all over the United States in solidarity with the people of Arizona, who see these laws as a larger part of local and national anti-immigrant sentiments and the increasing violence of hate speech as acceptable public discourse. Among the marchers was Alicia Gomez of Corpus Christi, Texas, who hosts a show on public radio focusing on the history of Texas prior to 1836. A speech pathologist by trade, she traveled to Phoenix for several reasons, and I want to read you this quote. She says, "I was an activist against the Vietnam War when I was in college and see this protest as a part of my civic duty. I protested in Austin against the appointment of Alberto Gonzalez during the Bush administration because of his plantation mentality, and I see the recent legislation in Arizona as a similar kind of misinformation that has to be contested," end quote. For another attendee, Dream Act activist Carlos Roa of Miami, Florida, attending the protests in Phoenix was fundamental to the larger desire to be in solidarity with undocumented immigrants in Arizona. He himself has been involved in the immigrant rights movement for the last 3 years and became active when he himself found out that he could not go to college because of his undocumented status. He was part of this 2010 spring walk by a group of students from Miami, Florida to Washington, D.C. called the Trail of Dreams. The students met with legislators as they passed through different districts to encourage the passage of the DREAM Act, which would have allowed students who entered the U.S. before they turned 16 and have been living here for more than 5 years to gain the documentation they need to enroll in post-secondary institutions. And if you've been following any of this, you would know that the DREAM Act just failed in Congress last month. Nonetheless, this sense of hope from the march carried into what a lot of us consider a temporary victory on July 6th of 2010, when the Justice Department reported that SB 1070 disrupts federal enforcement policies and priorities and resources that focus on aliens who pose a threat to national security. They further argued that the law conflicts and undermines national immigration policy. The brief asked that the law be declared invalid preliminarily and permanently. But as we know, many of us know, on February 10th of 2011, the state of Arizona filed a countersuit against the federal government, alleging that the federal government did not protect the citizens of Arizona. And this is an excerpt of the brief that you can read, because I'm not going to read it all. But there's another side to this debate that I think is really important that's not getting discussed. And critics disagree that SB 1070 is actually a profit-driven scheme backed by the Corrections Corporation of America, the largest private prison company in the nation based in Tennessee, a billion-dollar business, and ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, who lobbied 50 legislators around SB 1070, including bill sponsor and state Senate Majority Leader Russell Pierce. The Corrections Corporation of America believes that, quote, this is from their website, "Immigrant detention is their next big market," end quote. I want to read that. "Immigrant detention is their next big market." And NPR reports that Governor Brewer, quote, "has her own connections to private prison companies. State lobbying records show two of her top advisors, her spokesman Paul Sensman and her campaign manager Chuck Coughlin, are former lobbyists for private prison companies. Brewer signed the bill with Pierce as its sponsor. The Corrections Company of America and the other 50 people in the Hyatt conference room are all the ones that came up with the bill in a matter of 4 days. Thus, Brewer, Pierce, the Corrections Company of America, and ALEC seemed to make great bedfellows. They all acted with the intention to turn policing of brown bodies and the bodies of immigrants into a for-profit private industry in a moment of extreme economic crisis. And obviously, I think we can all think about how this would be appealing to a lot of people. So other states have caught what I'm calling the Arizona fever in terms of fear of the illegal immigrant body. The rise of deportation, this idea of a deportation nation, is something that anthropologists Nicolás de Genova and Natalie Putz argue in their anthology, The Deportation Regime. They think of this deportation nation concept as a problematic set of global policies. Such politics are as much about the freedom of movement as they are about border control and the exclusion of undesirable foreigners. In this deportation logic, stateless individuals who are racialized and thus unassimilable immigrants construct particular bodies as disposable and thus deportable. Take, for example, Mexico's Plan del Sur or Guatemala's Venceremos plans from 2009 that created large-scale tri-national collaborative militarizations of multiple national borders. And I should add that both of these programs were sponsored by the United States and aimed at stopping the flow of illegal migration from Central America into the U.S. Thus, deportation, it seems, has become the new answer to remedy and intercept mobile migratory bodies, a, quote, rightful enactment of laws by citizens against rightless aliens, end quote, according to Dejanova that I just quoted earlier. These practices began in the mid-2000s, or if we could go back to Sergio's presentation, he argues 1993, but I'm sort of focusing post-2000. For example, on May 12, 2000, officers from Immigration and Customs Enforcement Division of the Department of Homeland Security descended on a small northeast Iowa community of Pottsville with a population of 2,200, home to Agriprocessors, Inc., the largest kosher meatpacking plant in the United States. They raided the plant, arresting nearly 400 immigrant workers, most of them indigenous Guatemalans. These individuals were charged with felony aggravated identity theft, placed in chains, and taken to a tent encampment in the fairgrounds in the nearby town of Waterloo. There, they were advised to plead guilty, processed rapidly by judges, and sentenced to 5 months in prison and carted away. Making good use of the fact that ICE raids are, like this one, are not that frequent, all of the new state, county, and local legislation aimed at cracking down on illegal, and I put that in quotes, immigration, presents detention and deportation as the tidy technological solutions that operate away from the eye of the general public, that also compartmentalize spatial control. By enforcing policy in this brutal manner, this is the fundamental logic of the migrant body as deportable. People so believe in the deportation regime model, patented in places like Arizona, that Georgia, Mississippi, Florida, and even Nebraska have followed their lead. Examples of such laws include those in Cobb County, Georgia, in Ordinance 134-1. Cobb County's law is the response to the increase of Latino migrants, mostly of Mexican descent, working in the construction industry in the mid-2000s economic boom. According to legal scholars Pham and Van, such laws like this one, quote, act on the assumption that immigrants, particularly undocumented immigrants, often live together because of economic necessity. These laws seek to limit access to housing by restricting the density of these living arrangements, end quote. And obviously, the law in Fremont is very similar, right? And we'll talk about it in a little bit. One of the interesting things that you should know about this law is the ordinance requires that every household have 390 square feet of living space per adult occupant per vehicle. So what this means is that in a house of 1,200 square feet, the maximum number of adults you could have would be three. Why does this matter? Well, there's really obvious ramifications. This means higher costs for housing and a reduction of pooled resources, so often necessary to building capital, necessary to send remissions, as Sergio talked about earlier, and is somewhat gender-specific in targeting and criminalizing the Latino family and single migrant men who live in large numbers in one house. The consequences for violating such ordinances are staggering fines that often force those on the lease to be evicted or homeowners of these migrant houses, as they're often called, to go into default on their loans. Further, the enforcement of federal policy 287G that facilitates local and state officers to enforce federal immigration policy shows that 67% of those held for immigration-related issues were originally stopped for mere traffic offenses or no offense at all in Cobb County, Georgia. To be exact, in Cobb County, as one local newspaper states, quote, immigrants disappear into detention for violations such as broken taillights or tinted windows on their car. In 2008, Cobb County turned over 3,180 detainees to ICE for deportation. Of those, 2,180, or about 69%, were arrested for traffic violations, right? So this is a very sort of early incarnation of these driving while brown laws that are surfacing up in other places. So I'm going to talk about a place that no one's talking about, and I think it's a real sleeper and a really important thing, and that is what is going on in Mississippi. Mississippi's recently passed SB 2179 takes the most comprehensive approach to curtailing illegal immigration in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, I like to think of it as a kind of catch-up bill that does it all. And I want to remind everybody that we need to remember that President Bush suspended labor laws in Mississippi that mandated environmental protection and a suspension of union pay scales and minimum wage as part of federal rebuilding projects post-Katrina. Further, corporations in the rebuilding effort were offered lavish tax breaks, enabling them to profit from the misfortunes of poor people, and undocumented immigrants were cogs in the wheels of this machine. The suspension of these laws in the name of what scholar George Lipsitz has called hostile privatism allowed a number of undocumented workers to be brought in to rebuild the Gulf Coast. As Lipsitz has shown, there is a link between the imperialist and exploitative private firms such as Blackwater Security, who were called in to build Iraq after the U.S. invasion, and the millions of dollars in tax-free bonds awarded to private companies rebuilding the Gulf Coast after Katrina hit. Both the current immigration crisis and the war in Iraq are for-profit enterprises more than anything else, and I don't think I'm the only one that believes this, but we can argue about it. I love that. Placing the private sector in charge of state policy and privileging the private sector over the concerns of human rights and the state. So while the percentages of Latinos in Mississippi increased from 1.5%, or 39,569, in 2000 to a mere 2.9%, or 81,481 in 2010, the temporary suspension of labor laws enabled this flow of undocumented migrants into the Gulf Coast relatively unhampered. But now, as we face an economic depression, those bodies that once helped Mississippi get back on its feet in terms of the repair of homes, businesses, roads, bridges, state-sponsored construction projects, are now stateless and deportable, rendered disposable, and of surplus value. Set to take effect on July 1st, 2011, this bill supports the Mississippi Law Enforcement and Safe Neighborhoods Act. And I find the language of all of these bills really interesting because it's about safety, national security, right, and aliens. And so I think, you know, if nothing else, as all of these laws come out, we kind of want to key in and clue in on how these particular keywords may be saying safety, but they're actually saying something else, safety and insecurity for particular populations. So this Mississippi Law Enforcement and Safe Neighborhoods Act enacted the provisions that are intended to work together to discourage and deter the unlawful entry of aliens, there's that word again, not people, aliens, and economic activity by persons unlawfully present in the United States. Further, the law states that, quote, lawful stops by any law enforcement agency may be detained based on reasonable suspicion until the immigration status of the person is determined. And this notion of reasonable suspicion is the language that appears in almost every single one of these laws, and it's actually the grounds by which the Obama administration and the Department of Justice sued the state of Arizona. So what's interesting is a lot of these states that are writing this into, including Nebraska, writing this notion of reasonable suspicion into their laws are very careful to talk about this is not racial profiling, this is not discrimination on the basis of race, sex, or gender. But it's obviously manifesting in very concrete ways in those manners. So one of the sort of ramifications of this law is that if the suspicion is confirmed, the apprehended individual will be considered an offender on the basis of willful failure to complete and carry an alien registration document. The result would be a maximum fine of $100 and 30 days in jail for the first offense. The bill also covers unlawful transporting, moving, concealing, harboring, or shielding unlawful aliens, and vehicle impoundment. And based on the backlash against the Arizona law for its advocacy of racial profiling, the Mississippi bill states that, quote, a law enforcement official or agency of the state, a county, or municipality shall not consider race, color, or national origin in the enforcement of this section except to the extent permitted by the United States or Mississippi Constitution, end quote. So the determination of the violation is left to ICE or law enforcement, and the crime registers as a misdemeanor fine of $1,000 or greater. The bill consistently uses the word illegal alien, not non-citizen or undocumented, to communicate foreignness and incompatibility with the nation and ideas of citizenship. In other words, these aliens are not compatible with citizenship through the construction of their criminality and alterity. The other really important thing about this law is that it also has gender, sexual, and race implications. In the fourth section of SB 2179, there is a clause regarding domestic violence. If law enforcement is called out on a domestic violence claim in Mississippi, the officer is allowed to arrest without warrant and can then verify the immigration status of both the person arrested and the person making the domestic violence call. This echoes what scholar Uma Nayaran argued in 1995, that immigrant women have dependent immigration status and are more often economically, psychologically, and linguistically dependent on their spouses than wives in general. Further, as Kimberly Crenshaw remarked in 1995, the tragic consequences of what she calls double subordination, the fact that immigrant women were reluctant to leave abusive partners for fear of being deported or choosing the batterer over deportation, caused Congress to amend the 1990 Immigration Act, allowing for an explicit waiver for hardship caused by domestic violence. But in states like Mississippi and Arizona, they take to enforcing the federal law at the local level, and laws such as SB 2179 do not necessarily make exception to domestic violence. And as Crenshaw has argued, immigrant women are vulnerable to battering because they often do not meet the conditions of the federal waiver. As we can see, a domestic violence call could potentially result in not just the abuser being detained and perhaps deported based on his status, but it could also result in the deportation of the battered spouse, and if there are children who were born in the United States, the breakup of a family already embroiled in abuse. SB 2179 also seeks sanctions against employers, including the suspension of any licenses or permits granted by any agency or government entities on the first offense. The penalties are even stiffer for workers who take employment. If caught, they face a minimum of 1 year in prison, a felony charge, and anywhere between $1,000 and $10,000 in fines. This is a particularly important clause given that the labor laws that were suspended post-Katrina and the contractors and subcontractors hired in this matter could lose their licenses when the law takes effect this summer, roughly 5 years after the hurricane hit, and thus those same laborers who once rebuilt are now surplus bodies. So on to Nebraska, I'm bringing it home. All right, to the Prairie Heartland. So several people have brought up census status statistics today, and so not to bore you, but I think numbers, you know, talk to people in ways that perhaps I may not. So people may not know that in 2000, Nebraska's Latino population was roughly 94,425. And in 2010, the Census Bureau states an increase to 168,023, which represents a 70% overall increase. Now, what's interesting is that people are not saying, oh, you know, the difference between 168,000 and 94,000, you know, that's roughly, what, 70,000 more people. That's not a whole lot of people in a state that has roughly 1.5 million people. What they're focusing on is that 77%, right? And I think that that's highly problematic. And I think this 77%, right, is the reason that certain individuals are creating a sort of economic, moral, and social panic that has surfaced in the state. And thus, numerous attempts to curtail access to services for undocumented residents have been both successful and have also failed. For example, the Nebraska Legislature's Education Committee on February 14th killed the measure LB 657 from State Senator Charlie Jansen of Fremont. It would have repealed a 2005 state law that allows students whose parents brought them to the U.S. illegally to pay in-state tuition. To qualify, students must have graduated from Nebraska high schools, have lived in the state at least 3 years, and be pursuing or promised to pursue legal status. And so, in my opinion, luckily this was defeated. But the discussion of the new LB 48 initiative in Nebraska was pushed forward by the same man, Senator Charlie Jansen, who also authored the Fremont Ordinance and LB 657. LB 48, to exact, follows the lead of Arizona and Mississippi laws, making sure to note that, quote, the Illegal Immigration Enforcement Act shall be implemented in a manner consistent with federal laws regulating immigration, protecting the civil rights of all persons, and respecting the privileges and immunities of United States citizens. For the purpose of the act, a peace officer's reasonable suspicion, there it is again, shall not be based solely upon a person's race, color, religion, sex, or national origin, end quote. While addressing this racial profiling issue that allowed the federal government to sue the state of Arizona, the Nebraska law is careful to state that it is up to the peace officer to determine reasonable suspicion. But in a state where Anglo-Americans make up 86% of the population and Latinos make up 9.2%, it would make sense that Latinos would be targeted because of their obvious racial difference and the way that Latino identity in and of itself has become criminalized. So building his reputation as tough on immigration, Jansen also used his power on the City Council of Fremont, which is home to the nationally known meatpacking company Hormel, maker of Spam, and ironically, the holder of Mexican food brands La Victoria, Envasa, and Herdez. Yeah. We like your food, but we don't want you, right? Hormel, and I have a reference to that at the end of my talk. Hormel is the largest employer in this town, and what's interesting is that it preaches a work environment that it says, quote, is like being part of an extended family, end quote. But the city's new ordinance does everything possible to criminalize the Latino workers and their families that might very well be employed in the meat processing plant, much like the one raided in Iowa in 2008. With a population of 2,417, Latinos or Hispanics make up only 4.3% of the total Fremont population in 2009. City Ordinance 5165 passed June 21st of 2010 and kind of functions as a filtering system for federal immigration enforcement. Much like the Cobb County, Georgia law, City Ordinance 5165 makes it illegal to rent a dwelling to an illegal alien. Under Section A2, occupants may not enter into a contract to lease a business, apartment, or home without proof of legal residency in the United States. Renting or allowing the occupation of such spaces qualifies as harboring and reckless disregard, and the punishments to the owner of the dwelling are minimal at $100 per violation. Prior to leasing, the owner is required to verify all the usual information on a rental application, but with one difference. They must ask about citizenship status before agreeing to lease the property. The owner must pay a small fee of $5 to the city for processing, and if the person is deemed a legal resident, then it issues a license to lease. And here's an interesting part of the bill. It says, quote, all information provided on an application shall be maintained confidential by the city, except that the information on an application may be disclosed to other entities where authorized by law, end quote. And this obviously includes ICE for immigration law infractions. But I want to make another point about economics, which I think this is all very much about economics. Given that the median income for a household in Fremont was $36,700 and the median income for a family was $45,259, this fine perhaps of $100 could be a good sum of money for some, and perhaps people would bypass paying that $5 fee to the city. But still, I would argue that this law is not about recuperating money for the city, because the fines are so small, especially in comparison to the Arizona fines, which start at $1,000, or the Mississippi fines that start at $1,000, right? Rather, I think of this law as a fear tactic and the restriction of civil rights and personal rights, while the city government asserts domain over the private sphere and daily life. Further, this restriction of rental property creates a chain of dependency where either legal residents will rent to undocumented workers and put themselves at risk outside of the city's policy, or the city will get the reverse desired result. Undocumented immigrants will move out of the Fremont city limits. Much like the Mississippi law, the ordinance also covers the construction industry, and this is something I've been thinking about tremendously, is how there's a very gendered nature to these laws in terms of reproductive forms of labor, right? Thinking about men as working in construction and manual labor jobs and women as nannies, and I think that they're very specific and explicit about these gendered forms of labor that they try and police. In the legal realm. So much like that Mississippi law, the ordinance also covers construction, which roughly accounts for 15% of the total employment of Latinos in the United States. But while the ordinance requires that employers use E-Verify system for full-time employees, it also, quote, does not apply to the intermittent hiring of casual labor for domestic tasks customarily performed by the residents of the dwelling, end quote. So what's interesting is there's a loophole about day labor, right? So long-term employment, we're going to police that. But there's this tiny little loophole about day labor. And this minor loophole is an obvious inconsistency in the legislation, allowing temporary workers and their employers to be exempted for temporary work such as that performed by a handyman or a resident of the dwelling, irrelevant of immigration status. Yet, failure to comply with this law at the long-term level will result in the revocation of license, contracts, or grants to be paid by the city, but the ordinance says nothing of the worker who can potentially be intercepted through the system for being without papers. Ultimately, laws such as this one demonstrate how cities, counties, and states feel that the federal government's system to police immigration is flawed, slow, and ineffective. The Fremont Law is designed to link up with and expedite federal immigration policy, ultimately pushing for faster deportation. And this is one obvious way of funneling undocumented workers' information to the federal government, in some ways doing the work for the ICE with city government and local law enforcement. So I have some statistics here about dollars, because that's what this is about. So even though deportation is expensive and time-consuming, costing $122 per day per person, with an annual cost of $1.7 billion, states have shied away from the discussion of how the impetus for such new policies has to do with profit-driven private enterprises in correctional facilities. The moral panic about immigration is exploited to create a new economic opportunity, a hostile market where the undocumented body is at once rendered valuable and yet disposable. These city, county, and state ordinances do the work of ICE and yet expose the contradictory nature of the high demand for a workforce willing to work hard for low wages. Such legislative acts criminalize immigrants in an already extremely hostile economic environment where groups like the Tea Party, Minutemen, and law enforcement officers like Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Pyro argue that immigrants are taking our jobs and are all criminals. These representations of undocumented immigrants as illegal, criminal, and alien only reinvigorate long-standing discourses of nativism and racism that have historically dominated the national scene in this country through the peaks and flows of economic stability and crisis. So to paraphrase what Tom and Sergio and everyone said earlier, this is not new, it's just a new incarnation. And I always tell my students, right, the ideas are the same. It's the technologies of how the ideas are implemented that change. So this is my food reference and a nice image here from, maybe some of these folks are in the audience. I think they are. I think I just saw a few of them. these are my concluding remarks. The future, I think, is pretty clear, or is it? Arizona State Senator Russell Pierce has declared that the Arizona State Legislature will become the Tea Party Senate. And Shauna Ford, who organized a break-in at the home of Raul Flores to fund her anti-immigration group, murdering 8-year-old Briseña Flores in cold blood, is now being called an immigration activist by news outlets like the BBC and the Associated Press. This warped sense of what constitutes social justice, I'm afraid, demonstrates how hatred, racial profiling, and fear of the racialized body, be it immigrant or not, have become the hallmarks of the U.S. as a deportation nation or as a carceral state, to return to Jehenova's evocative words. But I believe there are other responses. We each have the capacity to act with compassion for our fellow humanity and can do small things in our everyday practices by recognizing that human rights do not need to be violated to make America safer. We do not have to create a personal hell for so many that a few can feel secure and free. We do not have to be governed by hysteria and fear of immigrants because of economic instability. Rather, this is a crucial moment in the history of this country, and we have the capacity to change the political landscape of America by seeing the disenfranchisement and punishment of others because of the color of their skin or their citizenship status by lobbying for humane reform, one person at a time. Thank you.